Broomfield. And representing the petitioner here, representing Mr. Broomfield, is Assistant State Public Defender Charles Vexton.
Thank you, Chief Justice, Justices of the Court. I think the orthodox way to begin this argument, or almost any argument, would be to give a brief summary of the issue or issues that are before the court. Unfortunately, in this case, I think that it at least evades my abilities to give a brief summary of what the parties agree to be the issue. In fact, I think if one were to quickly glance at the briefs of the parties in this case, it might seem as though we're each talking about an entirely different case. However, after reviewing the briefs, I think that there actually are more points of agreement and important points of agreement than might appear at first. And I've been able to enumerate five areas where I think the parties do agree. First of all, and most importantly probably, is that the parties do agree that information which one of the jurors in this case, who at that point was a prospective juror, Gerald McCann, heard before trial was potentially prejudicial. And indeed, I would say rather than potentially prejudicial, the information he heard I would characterize as inherently prejudicial. And to refresh everyone's recollection, what he heard while waiting for the process to begin was that my client, Mr. Broomfield, had pending trials, he was a gangster, he was a troublemaker, he had beaten a bunch of kids, he had been involved in drive-bys, and he had a prior trial where something had gone wrong. Second of all, although neither of the parties discussed it, I agree that there's a moral here that in this case, as in many cases, judicial economy would have been better served if the trial had been postponed and a new jury panel had been selected that did not include persons who had previously served at a separate trial involving Mr. Broomfield. Third, we both agree that Mr. Broomfield's defense lawyer at the trial should have asked prospective jurors whether any of them knew or had heard anything about his client before that point in time. Fourth, even though the record is clear that Juror McCann considered during deliberations what he'd heard about Broomfield, I agree with Mr. Lundstrom that evidence is not competent to consider. That the court really can only consider what it is that Mr. McCann heard. The court really can't consider what Mr. McCann did with that evidence once the trial began and he was charged with reaching a verdict. And finally, I think we agree that the significant, or at least a significant issue in this case, is precisely how to analyze this set of facts in terms of what really is the best legal analysis to use. Now, I've approached this case as a biased jury case, or a biased juror case. However, I would agree that that this case doesn't fit the box. It's not the typical biased jury case. The usual claim, and this is an issue, of course, that the justices of this court have dealt with frequently in the last year or two, usually this claim involves responses in jury selection. Either false answers, and I believe that's what's involved in the next case, Delgado, which this case is going to hear this morning, where the responses in jury selection are false, or they're honest answers, but those honest answers raise a question as to whether that juror should be stricken for cause because of some inherent knowledge that biases that juror. This case, on the other hand, doesn't involve any responses. And that's because no one asked the right questions. Now, because the right questions weren't asked, the state contends that the proper legal analysis here should be one of ineffective assistance of counsel.
And why not? Why wouldn't that be the correct procedure?
Well,
let me just follow up with another.
Sure.
Based on your summary presentation, I just have a question about, did the trial court find here that the juror that you're referring to was unclear about what he heard before the voir dire started? We have some question, and I have not read the record. It's down there, and I hope to look at it in the next few minutes. What is your recollection or observation about that, sir?
All right, let me try and answer the second question first. The trial court decision in regard to its finding about, let me back up for a second. The trial court made a determination that Mr. McCann, the juror who had heard this information, was a fair and impartial juror. And that part of the trial court decision would be found at pages 116 and 117 of my appendix. And let me say in response to that I think that there's at least three problems with the trial court decision in that regard. First of all, the trial court said that Mr. McCann was not specific about what was said. That's erroneous, and I think the state implicitly agrees with that. There's two parts to this. First of all, what did Mr. McCann hear before jury selection began? The second part is, what did Mr. McCann say to other jurors during deliberations, or what did other jurors say to Mr. McCann during deliberations about all this extraneous information? I'm conceding, as the trial court found and as the Court of Appeals relied on, that it was not clear what Mr. McCann said to other jurors or what other jurors said to him. It seems that there were discussions during deliberations about what was said, but Mr. McCann's recollection at this point, and again, the post-conviction evidentiary hearing in this case was about a year after the trial. He was not very clear about what was said and who said it. However, the point that the trial judge didn't consider or merged into that was that Mr. McCann was not specific about what was said. Mr. McCann was specific and was clear and did have a recollection about what was said to him, what he overheard other prospective jurors or other people in the courtroom saying before the jury selection process began.
Now, the juror, as I understand, just so we get this clear, the juror that allegedly said something was a member of the hung jury, and he did not sit on this jury, right? So the juror that allegedly said these things did not sit.
Actually,
we don't know?
We don't even know that the person that missed. Nobody was talking to Mr. McCann. What Mr. McCann testified to was that he's sitting in the courtroom waiting for the case to get started, just like there's many people here who were sitting here waiting for this case to start. Mr. McCann simply overheard two other people talking to each other. He doesn't know who they are. As a matter of common sense, it seems very likely that at least one of those people was one of the jurors who had been called on the prior case. But we don't know that as a fact. And from my perspective, it doesn't really matter, because what counts is what is the substance of what Mr. McCann heard, not the identity of that person. I'm assuming, but we don't know that, I'm assuming that the person that Mr. McCann heard it from was not somebody who sat on the jury.
Why does that make any difference when Mr. McCann testified that he didn't use the information and that he swore to be a fair and impartial juror and based his decision solely upon the facts in the case? Why would that make any difference then? If here we overhear a casual conversation and we're very indefinite about what it was, indefinite about who said it, and then the juror that Juror McCann testifies that whatever it was, it didn't influence him.
Counsel, I think I just looked at the record. I think on 44-14-14, he did say that he thought one of them was a juror, just for your information.
Okay. Thank you.
Are you going to respond to Justice Lockhart?
Sure. First of all, Mr. McCann was indefinite about who said it. He wasn't indefinite about what he heard.
Oh, yes.
And as I suggest, the substance is what counts. Second of all, I think consistent with the state's analysis, as to him saying whether he was influenced by it would be incompetent evidence, and I don't really believe that's what his testimony was. I think the substance of his testimony at the post-conviction hearing really showed an inability on his part to separate out what he had heard in the courtroom before the trial process started from what he heard during the trial, and I think that's one of the real differences between a case such as this from a case such as Messelt, which I had discussed at some length in my brief, where there we have a juror who heard something some 10 years previously. Here we have a situation where the juror is hearing something immediately before formal testimony begins, and hears it right in the courtroom. In that situation, when we're talking about a lay juror, it's not very clear as to what he should or should not consider. If you talk about evidence as what you're hearing in the courtroom, well, this is something that he heard in the courtroom. And the other point that I think has to be taken into account is because this didn't surface at all during the jury selection process, that there was no attempt at a curative instruction. Now, this is a point that the state and I seem to disagree on. What the record shows, and I don't think there really is any dispute about the facts. There may be a dispute as to how we interpret it. But when the jury selection process wound up in a disclosure that there had been this prior trial that had ended in a hung jury, the trial court extemporaneously gave a special instruction during the selection process and said, what happened, this prior trial shouldn't concern you. You shouldn't be involved in that. But what we're talking about in this case, Justice Wilcox, is not prejudice from knowing about a prior trial. We're talking about particular substantive allegations which are inherently prejudicial. The fact that Mr. Broomfield supposedly was a gangster. He was a troublemaker. He'd beaten kids. He was involved in drive-by shooting. Now, the trial judge never gave any type of curative instruction saying, can you put aside the fact that you heard Mr. Broomfield was a gangster? Do you realize that's not evidence in this case? There was no instruction whatsoever because, and I'm not blaming the trial judge for that. He didn't know
Mr. Vester. Didn't he give a general instruction that said you're to rule on only the evidence in this case and not matters outside the record or something? There's a general instruction.
Well, sure.
He gave that. Why didn't that cover this?
Well, as I say, I think, first of all, when you're hearing specific allegations of wrongdoing of this nature, I think that there's a need to specifically address that. Certainly,
well, you wouldn't want the judge to say to the jury, this guy has been accused of being a gangster, drive-by shootings, but forget it, right? You wouldn't want the judge to say that.
I think there's a strong argument that it could be made had this information surfaced. And during jury selection, that if Mr. McCann were not able to say with a reasonable degree of certainty that he would not consider that he didn't know it to be true, that there would be a basis to strike Mr. McCann for cause. I think that in a situation where the information would surface, that if there would be a basis to strike him for cause, that certainly where this information didn't surface and there was no opportunity for counsel in the court to try and clarify for the prospective juror whether he could or could not consider it, that I think that the likelihood of potential prejudice is all the greater. Let's remember that it was only a short time ago that this court, a majority of this court, concluded that where a juror expressed some hesitancy or uncertainty about whether or not he could, whether he would be influenced or uninfluenced by the fact that that the defendant didn't testify, and I'm speaking of the Farring case, of course, that if that was potentially inherently prejudicial, despite extensive questioning by the judge and the prosecutor and defense counsel to try and clarify for the juror that he couldn't consider it. Here we have a situation where nobody told Mr. McCann, listen, whatever you heard about this guy before we got started, forget about it.
Well, what about in the record here? Wasn't he asked? Did he consider it? Could he have set it aside? Was he impartial? I mean, after the fact, didn't he get asked that?
Well, again, I think he was asked to some extent about. He certainly was asked what he had heard. I think to ask, again, when we're asking him whether or not he set it aside, whether he considered it, is, again, incompetent evidence. But if we're going to look at that incompetent evidence, I think the incompetent evidence
goes
to my benefit.
Mind. Okay,
what the incompetent evidence shows during the evidentiary hearing is that Mr. McCann believed that he and the other jurors considered everything they could, what they knew about Mr. Broomfield, in deciding whether or not he was, was guilty.
Counsel, where do you get that? I was just trying to go through the. But they considered everything, including the extraneous information. That's what I was asking.
Well, at page 20 of the post-conviction hearing, when he was asked about whether he considered the allegations of a drive-by shooting, he said that's what we were back there doing, deciding if he was guilty. Basically, everything that he was asked about what he had heard, how that influenced him, he basically merged everything together, and that's why the substance of the state's argument here is that all of these responses by Mr. McCann on what he did with that information is incompetent, and I'm really not disputing the fact that that's incompetent, but it seems to me since we know, but we can't consider whether or not it is what he did with that information. We have to analyze it the way we ordinarily would analyze it, is whether or not a reasonable juror would be able to set it aside. In the Farring case, Justice Wilcox, you defined manifest bias as one of two situations: whether the juror is a reasonable person willing to put aside an opinion, and whether a reasonable person in the juror's position could set it aside. Well, what I would submit in this case is, because Mr. McCann was never asked or told that he should set it aside, how could we possibly assume that he would or did set it aside? The whole problem in this case stems from the fact that nobody knew that he had heard these things, and that's, of course, the reason why the state is attempting to argue that this would be treated as an ineffective assistance of counsel case by not eliciting that.
Can I ask you, and I've lost the train then, you think it's not an ineffective assistance of counsel? Just give me in one sentence, why not?
Well, that was the question Wilcox asked before also, that I was just going to try and come back to.
Okay.
For two reasons. First, I don't think that... While I think that it was bad practice on the part of defense counsel not to ask a question that would have elicited that, I don't think the responsibility for eliciting potential prejudice lies solely on the part of defense counsel. It's a joint responsibility for counsel and the court. And second of all, I don't think that the traditional prejudice analysis really applies very well when we're talking about a situation of a biased juror. Let me try and amplify.
Sorry, just so I understand the facts, but no one knew, neither the defense nor the prosecution, that the juror, Mr. McCann, had overheard this conversation. Isn't that correct? They asked what happened here, as I understand it. They asked what I call the basic questions on voir dire, you know, both sides. And they had there was no quote expectation, other than perhaps they should have been alerted because of the fact that there were at least 8 people who had been involved in a hung jury.
I think in this case they asked less than the basic questions. And as I suggest in my brief, I think the reason they asked less than the basic questions is because everyone got so, if you use the word hung up, everybody got so involved in the hung jury jurors being there that they were so aware of the potential prejudice from this situation that they kind of lost the big picture for the other thing.
Let me interrupt for a minute, because I'm having trouble with your argument that ineffective assistance of counsel isn't applicable. The attorney that was representing your client in this case had also represented him in the previous case where the hung jury had occurred. Is that not correct?
That's correct.
And apparently everybody knew in this case that at least a substantial part of the jury panel was from that hung jury, if I remember correctly, 8 of them.
Well, there were 8 who actually got called to the panel, presumably or possibly the other 4 were in the group that never got called into the box.
Okay, yep. Now let's pretend you're sitting in counsel chair, I'm sitting on the other side, we're the 2 attorneys in the case. We're well aware of the situation that we've got a jury panel with a substantial number of jurors from a hung jury in the past. Wouldn't it make sense? Wouldn't you expect that you would have asked some questions in regard to whether or not there had been any discussions among the jurors, any extraneous information discussed relating to that prior case, relating to the defendant? I mean, wouldn't that be a normal expectation for an attorney defending this particular defendant, given the fact that he'd also been involved as well in that other case?
I'd like to think that I would have been concerned about that. I would note that at page 42 of the post-conviction hearing transcript, which is record entry 44, that the trial attorney testified that he hadn't considered the possible contamination of the jury panel by those prospective jurors.
Well, wouldn't you feel that the state's concession is correct, that really was ineffective assistance? In other words, that the first prong of the Strickland test indeed is met in this situation?
I'm not strenuously arguing against ineffective assistance of counsel, particularly where opposing counsel is conceding there was deficient performance. I think in the big picture, Justice Crooks, speaking strictly as an advocate, I would be ineffective if I didn't welcome that type of confession and say the only issue is prejudice. In the big picture, though, it just strikes me as a little bizarre to be saying that the right to an impartial jury was waived by failing to ask a particular question. And then to say that because the evidence of guilt was overwhelming, that everything's okay. Suppose this jury was composed of 12 friends of Dorothy Seaman, who was the victim in this case, and they spent the entire time during jury selection and during the jury just sort of waiting for their moment to be able to vindicate her rights and find this defendant guilty. Would we say, first of all, that the issue of Mr. Broomfield's right to a fair jury was waived because the lawyer simply forgot to ask, does anybody know or related to the victim in this case? And second of all, would we say, no harm, no foul, we think this guy's guilty. So the fact that this jury was determined to find him guilty before they ever took their oath, waived the problem. So I just don't see that. As I say, I think I really have problems with the prejudice analysis.
Isn't that the point? That's why you're avoiding ineffective assistance of counsel, because you don't want to get to the second prong of prejudice.
Well, I'm happy to get to the second prong of prejudice in my next 5 minutes, perhaps.
Right. Well, just think about the fact that even if you have to have prejudice, maybe sometimes prejudice is assumed. One of the cases, don't they talk about structural prejudice? Think about that.
All right.
Counsel, Mr. Lundstrom, Assistant Attorney General, representing the state of Wisconsin.
Chief Justice, members of the court. I don't know that I agree with all those 5 points, especially as he developed each one of them. We're certainly not talking about information that was inherently prejudicial. My biggest area of confusion is why this isn't a clear case of extraneous information. This is an extraneous information case. And this court has, in several prior cases, laid forth a way to analyze those situations. We have a juror who heard before trial some information that was potentially prejudicial. We have in our case law the way we analyze that. Because Rule 90606 prevents us from intruding on the jury room, we think in terms of a hypothetical average juror. What effect would this have had on a hypothetical average juror? So we take the information that we know, which is Justice Wilcox, I think, fairly clear what he heard prior to trial. There isn't any real dispute about that.
And he heard gangster?
I believe that was a word.
Drive-by shooting? What else? Just a reminder.
Drive-by shooting, well, those I didn't commit to memory.
Okay.
But he was involved in roughing up kids. And
not gangster gang, I think.
So it was, it was bad stuff to say about a person. I don't dispute that. But for the analysis for the case, under your case law, Paul, Chief Justice Abramson's decision and other cases, we look at how would that affect that juror in the context of this very case. We're not trying to determine whether that created a bias or we're saying in the context of this case, would it have affected a hypothetical average juror? So we get to do two things. We get to look at the context in which he heard it, which is important, and we also get to look at the trial in this case, this case was a prosecutor's dream case. I mean, this was the Mr. Blank would love to have this case every day. You walk in, you've got an eyewitness to the theft, you have an implausible story from the defendant. Even the defense that's raised on appeal, the notion that the accomplice, Mr. Sparger, might have told the defendant that he had permission, was brand new on appeal. The defense attorney never argued it. There was no testimony to that effect that Broomfield thought that the other guy had permission. So we look at it all, and here's what we have. We have a situation where prior to trial, he overhears this information and then has every reason to believe that he overheard it from jurors who sat in this prior case. And the judge, I think, albeit inadvertently, made very clear that that was not reliable information. He said that that was a hung jury. He said that there was no verdict and that there had been a lot of dispute among those jurors about what occurred. So I don't think, when Mr. McCann, the juror, testified, he did start to say something about how he put it aside, or I forget the exact phrase, he kind of shrugged it off a little bit. I mean, there was testimony to that effect. It was cut off. It wasn't developed. So there's good reason for him not to think that that was not reliable information. And then if you put it in the context of this case, which was an overwhelming case, the jury was out 25 minutes total from the time they left the courtroom to the time they came back. You know, it's barely enough time to pick a foreman and you know, agree on a procedure and cast a vote. Mr. McCann's testimony, you know, that everybody agrees was inadmissible about how it was discussed big time just is patently not the case. I mean, there wasn't even time to hardly discuss the facts that they did hear, much less go off on tangents about something that they might have heard before trial. So that's my main pitch in this case, is this is a typical extraneous information case.
Now, suppose that, and I'm sure you're familiar with the next case we're going to hear, suppose that the juror here had been asked, had he heard anything or known anything about this defendant, and said, didn't respond affirmatively, so just was silent, right?
Yes.
Then what would the approach be?
Well, that would have been an inaccurate answer. So then I think you have a Wiest analysis that falls pretty clearly under Wiest approach. And under Wiest, you do, in fact, take a different approach to the whole issue, and you try to do a retroactive determination of bias. That answer your question?
Yes, that does. How does...
Mr. Lunsman, let me ask you, do you agree with what Mr. Vetzner was saying earlier, that part of the reason this isn't an ineffective assistance of counsel situation is because some of the burden was on the trial judge, that the trial judge, knowing the circumstances, should have asked more detailed questions himself at voir dire?
I don't agree. Certainly, trial judges have this supervisory responsibility for voir dire to make sure that things are done accurately. For example, if there had been inadequate questions asked, and then it came time for the judge to make a determination under Farron about whether the juror was biased, I think the judge would be abusing his discretion if he made a ruling without a sufficient record. I mean, if the defense attorney highlighted an area of bias, and there weren't sufficient clarifying questions so the judge could make an informed decision, that would be an abuse of discretion. But that's different than saying that the judge had some affirmative duty to ask the questions in the first place, because under very clear case law of this court, in Lewis at least, we assume that jurors are impartial, and it's up to the challenging party to establish bias. In a lot of trials, a lot of voir dires, not every question gets asked. We don't expect the trial judge to step in and do the defense attorney's job for them. Trial judges, I'm sure, they don't view it to be their job to sort of particularize their voir dire to the kind of case at hand or what might have happened in that case. It's the defense attorney's job to uncover bias. I don't see where it's any different than, the countless other situations where if a defense attorney doesn't do his job, we consider it a waiver. And in many of those other situations, it could have been apparent to the trial judge that there was a problem. The trial judge could have stepped in. If there's plainly inadmissible evidence that comes in during trial, anybody who's with some legal background or some common sense could tell that it shouldn't have come in. Trial judges could step in, but we don't. We say it's not their job. It's the defense attorney's job to make these objections. And so, in that respect, I don't see why this is any different than any other of the situations where we hold defendants to waiver.
Let me just ask. The standard of our review when the circuit court finds no bias, which I gather the circuit court found here, is that we would overrule only if the bias is manifest.
That's true. I agree
with
that.
What does that mean?
Well, in this case, I think it doesn't mean very much because I think this is not a Wiest situation. We're not trying to make a retroactive determination of bias. So his ruling in that respect, I would argue, is just irrelevant.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Because the issue isn't whether juror McCann was biased. The issue is whether a hypothetical average juror who heard this extraneous information would have been affected in the context of the entire case.
Okay. Suppose that the trial judge here had allowed the juror knew, or had heard, I shouldn't say knew, had heard, suppose they had allowed that as other acts evidence. So you had a witness that testified that was his reputation. Of, I don't care whether it was permissible to let in, but it got in. And now you have the exact same case. You got all the jurors have heard that.
Mm-hmm.
What would you do with that case?
Well, it's a hard hypothetical to answer. There would have been a limiting instruction. I mean, even if the judge admits it is over the act's evidence, he's got to admit it for some purpose. And so, are you suggesting he admitted it without a limiting instruction?
We can take it both ways. Let's take it with a limiting instruction.
Well,
he says you can use this to show character for, what is it, plan, intent, and this was a plan, you know, he's a planning with a bad guy. Intent, motive. His motive is what he wants, money. And that all his other crimes show that same tendency.
Mm-hmm.
Forgotten with the others, but that's enough. We can limit it to motive, intent, plan.
Well, it makes a big difference. Of course, the analysis then would be harmless error.
That's right, which is really your analysis here, too.
It is, but there's a big factual difference in how the information came to the jurors' attention. I mean, one of the things I'm saying is that this came in very similar to gossip, something he overheard, something he had good reason to believe wasn't reliable, very different than evidence that would come into the courtroom.
You don't have to be convicted to indicate other acts. I mean,
right.
You don't have a conviction. This is what they say.
I'm sorry.
What I'm driving at, which I think you know very well what I'm driving at, is that you're really going in on the harmless error test. It's ineffective assistance of counsel, and I think you wind up saying this was extraneous information. Would a hypothetical juror have been affected by this? If affected, would it make any difference? I mean, even if he knew it, right? Because it's erroneous that he knows it. So both of you seem to be avoiding the harmless error test, and I don't know why.
Well, I tried to address it very directly. I mean, it's not called harmless error.
Okay.
Is the test very similar? It certainly is. I mean, I believe it's Poe again when we're talking about Chapman and we're comparing the tests. Like harmless error, we're looking at the entire context.
Okay. But looking in the entire context, then what would you say about where all the jurors hear this evidence?
Just as I argued earlier, I mean, when you hear it in the context of it being gossip and the judge instructing you that it doesn't come from a very reliable source because the jurors disagree, and then you also overlay on it a very strong case, then I think you can be confident that this information didn't affect the jury.
If you don't view this as harmless error, then your concession that it was ineffective assistance of counsel doesn't count for much. I mean, you agree with Mr. Betzner?
No, not at all, because, from this court's perspective, it may not make that much difference. But to the people who litigate at the post-conviction level, it makes a big difference, because we're talking about the burden of proof. Who has to come forward with the evidence that there was extraneous information and that it was prejudicial? So I think, whereas right now, it's true, the facts are fairly well established now. I mean, they are established now. And you are ruling essentially as a matter of law, de novo, whether this had an effect on the verdict. Very little difference, maybe no difference between this and harmless error. But it makes a big difference in terms of how the case comes up to you and how it gets litigated below. So
why don't you just ride the horse, if you will, of ineffective assistance of counsel all the way and indicate that you feel there's no prejudice here? Isn't that really what you're saying?
It is what I'm saying. I am saying that the prejudice prong in this case, the way you analyze it, is exactly that there's no prejudice. The defendant has the burden to show prejudice. He has come forth with facts. This record does show the defendant in this case did come forth with a record that provides him a basis to argue that he was prejudiced.
Why do you feel there's no prejudice?
Because of the strength of the state's case and because of the nature of the way this juror overheard it and the fact that he had every reason to think that what he overheard wasn't reliable information. And again, I really have to emphasize that, I can't detail the evidence for you, but I hope you read my brief. But, I mean, it was almost a laughable locked case in this case. The notion that a 15-year-old girl, that the defendant somehow thought a 15-year-old girl without a driver's license had given his friend, who hadn't seen the girl recently, but he did, permission to take the car, is sort of laughable. Even the defense attorney in the trial didn't try it. It's, you know, in retrospect, with, you know, in our job as Monday morning quarterbacks, with time to think about it, I guess, you know, the idea came up. Mr. Vetzner thought of that approach. But it wasn't even attempted at trial.
Counsel,
go ahead.
It's precisely because of that, because of that, as you, in essence, characterize it, a slam dunk case, that I think we have to be very careful about any analysis that we do before we get to a slam dunk case. Let's go through the Poe analysis. First prong of Poe is testimony competent under 90606 sub 2? Your response, as I understand it, would be as to what he heard it is competent. Is that correct or is that incorrect?
Because 90606 covers what happens in the jury room. Mm-hmm. And he's just directly testifying about what he heard prior to trial.
So
the rule doesn't even apply.
It is competent testimony.
Yes.
Is that correct? That he overheard man and woman behind him talking about him, the defendant being a gangster, about pending cases against the defendant. The defendant beat up kids, that there were he was involved in drive-bys, that they said they didn't want to be on another jury, that something went wrong with the first one, that those kinds of things. He was competent to testify regarding those. Is that correct?
Yes.
Now, the next prong of the Poe test is, does the evidence show substantial grounds for overturning the verdict? And the standard, as I understand it, is clear and convincing evidence that the alleged extraneous information reached the jury and could bias the jury. What about the argument that obviously it reached the jury because this guy was a juror? And arguably that hearing someone say that he was a gangster, involved in drive-by shootings, beat up kids, and had other cases might bias him. Do you think it passes the second prong of the Poe test?
It definitely does.
Then we get to the third prong, whether the verdict should be overturned because the error was prejudicial. As I understand it, there's a difference between the criminal and civil, and in criminal, there's reasonable possibility of the standard. Also said beyond a reasonable doubt in criminal cases, the beneficiary of the error must prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the error did not contribute to the verdict. So that's what you have to do. Is that correct?
But the defendant has to show that there's a reasonable possibility that this information affected a hypothetical average juror. That's the language in Poe, and that's the language that I, you know, I
see. Isn't that always the case in any prejudicial error case?
Well, apart from the who has the burden. And as you point out, by the time cases get to you, largely who had the burden down below, you don't care about much. But I want to stress, litigants below care.
Could you tell me again what you say is the third prong of the Poe test?
The
standard, whether the verdict should be overturned because error is prejudicial, but what's the standard, as you understand it, in the Poe test?
It is essentially the Chapman standard, and as articulated in this context, we're talking about whether or not this information contributed to the verdict, and the language used in Poe is whether there's a reasonable possibility that the extraneous information would have had a prejudicial effect on a hypothetical average juror.
Do you believe that there's a reasonable possibility that gangster, drive-by shooting, etc., might have a effect on a hypothetical juror?
No, I do not. And, you know, I have been arguing harmless error for a long time now, and I think the justices, you know, maybe this language isn't even that helpful. It's sort of, you know it when you see it. It's kind of hard to articulate, but this is one of the strongest harmless error cases I've ever had the chance to argue.
But you know it when you see it. It's kind of an interesting response, because if I heard someone say, this defendant over here
is a gangster, beats up kids, involved in drive. I don't mean to be pointing at you, Jack. Let me point at someone else. Involved in drive-by shootings, has other cases pending, and got off on a technicality on a prior trial.
Mm-hmm.
Boy, that just might affect me.
Well, the last part you said about technicality in the prior trial didn't happen here.
No, thank you. You said that, just a minute, you said something went wrong in one of them. That was the phrase on page 14 of the transcript.
Well, I would hope you would consider who you heard it from. I mean, if you were then told that these were jurors who sat on, or you overheard it from someone who sat in a hung jury where there was a lot of dispute,
mm-hmm.
and in fact there wasn't a conviction because of dispute over what happened, I would hope you would think, well, that's not a very reliable source.
So does it boil, under going through the poll analysis, does it boil down to if I heard it and people, there was a suggestion that they had been in the trial, one of them had been another juror. If I say, must have been an acrimonious trial, that's what the judge said, I'm going to discount that, then the third prong of the poll analysis isn't met. But if I'm a hypothetical juror and I say, gosh, that guy sounds like a bad actor to me, then it is met. So it's just all in the eyes of who this hypothetical juror is. And those words are kind of strong for me.
And there's no doubt that this case involved judgment, that that you will be needing to decide what would a reasonable person, essentially if that's what it is,
mm-hmm.
what would a reasonable person have thought about this information, and would it have affected them once they heard this evidence?
Just one final question then. As I understand it, you pretty much say that the first two prongs of the Poe test have been met here.
Yes.
So we're really focusing on this third prong, and if a reasonable juror would have been affected by hearing that information, then what?
Would have been affected? Then I think you've got a reversal and a new trial.
Sure.
Okay.
Now here, in this case, and I think you characterized this as like in the Massault case, it's like the gossip that was overheard by one of the jurors in that case. And I note in the post-conviction hearing that when they were asking juror McCann about the effect this had, he kind of shrug it off. He never got to finish his answer because defense counsel didn't allow him to, or cut in, as I recall, but he just sort of said, I kind of shrugged it off. So there wasn't any, that's the only indication that we have of what he thought. I'm talking about juror McCann. And I mean, that's the only thing I know of in the record that was said about that.
Well, to be candid, he said conflicting things. He said other things that indicated it was talked about in the jury room, mm-hmm. which would indicate that he was thinking about it, I guess. So I'm not going to tell you that he was clear, that he clearly said he discounted it.
Mm-hmm.
It's unclear. I am saying there's indications that he did say he did discount it, but we don't know. What's really much more important than that is that that's not competent evidence. That whether he did or didn't is something that should not be considered by the court. We need to look at this because there is such an important film of protection placed over jury deliberations. We have 90606.
And that's maybe why Judge Lusso said, and I asked this before, found that juror McCann was unclear about. So you're saying we're not clear about what he said, and that was the finding of the trial judge.
Yes.
Okay.
But your answer to Justice Bradley on the second ground under the Poe test is that the assumption here is that it did reach the jury because at least one juror knew about it. So you pass that. If you didn't pass that test, you'd never get to three.
Right.
So that the finding is not relevant because the assumption is made it did get to the jury because this juror knew. More than one may have known, but this juror knew, and one vote is enough in the sense of as your turn. I do want to reassure you that the court understands your issue on burden of proof. If this was a straight appeal and there was error here,
the state might have to prove that the error did not contribute to the verdict. Beyond a reasonable doubt, that is. Where it's ineffective assistance of counsel, and you show error, which you then concede here is ineffective assistance of counsel, the burden on a proof for prejudice, assuming they're the same, and it doesn't matter if they're the same, goes to the defendant. And it may not make any difference here when we have a record developed, but how we write the case is important for the trial courts and trial counsel, because how you write the case may shift the burden there. That's the point you repeatedly made to us.
Yes.
And we've always skipped over that, but I did want to assure you.
Thank you. And just one little point on and I think it's already clear, but the what was said in the jury room might have been relevant evidence, for example, if Juror McCann had become unavailable. If he was unavailable to tell us what he heard before trial, then another juror might have been able to say, well, Juror McCann was talking about this in the jury room. And that, but only because it was evidence of what Juror McCann heard from an extraneous source. Because we didn't need that in this case, then everything that went on in the jury room essentially became irrelevant because it was so unclear. And I also, one last thing I want to stress, I think is important to the decision, if you write it as an ineffective assistance of counsel decision, is that my concession on ineffective assistance on the performance prong is quite narrow. You know, it's not always going to be ineffective assistance for a defense counsel to fail to ask certain questions. It really is important in this case, as I think was highlighted during the first part of the argument, that what this defense counsel knew about this case and knew that these jurors had intermingled. And so if there aren't any further questions.
Thank you, Mr. Ronson. Mr. Betzner?
Thank you. Enough of this goody-two-shoes about where we agree. Let me point out some areas.
Now that he doesn't have another chance, right? Go ahead.
First of all, is this an extraneous information case? In the prior cases this court's decided, particularly in Massalt or Messalt, whatever, however it's pronounced, I think this court drew a very clear distinction between using a biased juror analysis and an extraneous information analysis, depending on when the information came to the attention of the juror. When it comes to the attention of the juror before the trial process starts, this court did not use an extraneous information analysis. However, even if this court is inclined to do so, I think that the test for prejudice or harmless error then is not as clear as the state would argue. And in that regard, I'd mentioned that I had sent a letter to this court mentioning a fairly recent federal court of appeals decision, United States versus Nashfar, which involved a situation where, involving extraneous information, where tapes had been sent to the jury room that had not been played during the trial. And the court of appeals said that this was not a case to be using a harmless error analysis. This was a situation where the judge had abdicated control of the courtroom because the jury was able to play these tapes, and it allowed a conviction on the basis of evidence not presented at trial. I would submit that here also we have a situation where at least one juror may very well have made a decision to convict on the basis of evidence, quote-unquote evidence, that was not presented at trial. Now, in regard to prejudice for an ineffective assistance of counsel analysis, the test for prejudice, I would submit, is not how overwhelming the issue of guilt is, but whether or not the defendant was denied a fair trial and whether we have confidence in the outcome. And the case that I think should be most helpful to this court on prejudice, and I apologize, I did not cite this case in my brief, and I should have, is a decision of this court, State versus Johnson, 133 Wissec. That was a case where this court held there was ineffective assistance of counsel, where the lawyer had failed to inform the court of questions about the client's competence to stand trial. And the key part of the analysis, the court did not consider whether the evidence of guilt was overwhelming. It didn't talk at all about the evidence of guilt. What the court said was, where counsel fails to bring the issue of competency to the court's attention, and there is reason to doubt the defendant's competence to stand trial, the defendant is deprived of a fair trial, thereby undermining confidence in the outcome. I think that's analogous to what we have here. Counsel failed to inquire into the juror's partiality, and there is reason to doubt partiality. Therefore, the defendant was deprived of a fair trial, undermining confidence in the outcome. After all, how can we have confidence in the outcome if the jurors weren't unbiased? It's the most preliminary threshold for having confidence in the outcome that we have a jury of 12 persons, good and true, who are going to decide the case based on the evidence. We don't have that here. Now, why do I still have, since I think the prejudice test accrues to my benefit, why do I still have hesitation about using an ineffective assistance of counsel analysis? In preparing for the argument, I looked at the judicial bench book. What it said was, quote, the judge has the principal role in examination of jurors, and it suggested questions for the judge. And there was one question at least fairly close to this in terms of standard questions. Have you heard or read anything about this case? Although there wasn't any question, have you heard or read anything about the defendant? Also, if you look at Wisconsin Statute Section 805.081, it makes it clear that it's the responsibility of the judge to determine whether prospective jurors have any bias or prejudice. So, and I know I'm speaking to a group of persons who have been either trial judges or practiced in front of trial judges, and we all know that the trial judges will engage in questioning. After all, this case wasn't any different. It was the trial judge who started asking the questions. In reality, well, I guess it's a typical defense lawyer. My position would be, if we use an ineffective assistance of counsel analysis, I think I should win. We have deficient performance. I think under the appropriate prejudice test, did the deficient performance deprive the defendant of a fair trial? And was there a lack of, should there be confidence in the outcome? I think the answer is no fair trial, lack of confidence in the outcome. In conclusion, maybe it's coming out of the blue, but because this case doesn't really fit the box for any of these analyses.
Can I interrupt for a moment?
I'm done.
Finish your sentence, then I'll ask you.
Well, I was going to say the red light is on is what I meant. I really think that the best analysis here really might be, should there just be a new trial granted in the interest of justice? It doesn't fit any of our classic molds for analysis. It doesn't meet extraneous evidence. It doesn't really meet the typical biased jury case. And because of what I pointed out, I'm not certain that we really want to hang all the blame on the defense lawyer.
What if we simultaneously conclude in our deliberations that, number one, there was bias, that we had a prejudice theory, but number two, the evidence of guilt is just incredibly overwhelming? What do we do?
I think that you either grant a new trial because the real controversy wasn't fully tried, or you grant a new trial on the basis of ineffective assistance of counsel, because even though you thought the evidence was overwhelming, we can't have confidence in the outcome. As I said, it's certainly more extreme than we have here, but what if the evidence at a post-conviction hearing showed all 12 jurors were buddies of the victim, and they were just waiting for their chance to get back there? Maybe that's why the jury, that's why it only took 25 minutes, because they were waiting for their chance to vindicate their rights. Would we say that even though the evidence was overwhelming, where we know that the jurors weren't fair, where they had their mind made up beforehand, that it's too bad? We're talking about pretty absolute bare minimums here to have an unbiased judge and to have an unbiased jury, and we don't have that in this
case. Are you saying that when it is established that one juror was biased, that the rule of law is that there must be a new trial?
Yes.
But here, was it established that one juror was biased?
I guess that. Yeah, well, we can go back to being buddies again. I think that if you read the state's brief, I think they're agreeing. The state is agreeing that this was, it called this information potentially prejudicial, which I would characterize as meaning inherently prejudicial. And why is it saying the evidence wasn't prejudicial? only because it's saying the evidence was overwhelming. That doesn't change whether or not the juror was biased. We had a biased jury. What the state is arguing is, even though we had a biased jury, just what Justice Babbage is saying, well, we had a biased jury, but this was a slam dunk case. I suggest if it's a slam dunk case, if the court's concerned, if it was such a slam dunk case before, maybe it'll be a slam dunk case the second time around, that it's appropriate for this court to vindicate the rule of law, not to worry about reversing because it's supposedly a slam dunk. Thank you very much for your
time. Thank you, Mr. Vetzner. Thank you, Mr. Lundston. We'll see you both in Madison. The Assistant Attorney General and Assistant Public Defender argue many cases before us. We are now in recess.